The kids can go ahead and be dismissed out the back for junior church. All right. So, am I on? I don't know. Can you guys hear me? Am I on? It says I'm on. I don't know. Should I just steal one of these? Is it on? All right, good. He doesn't want to take credit. He said he did nothing. All right. We started our Advent season last week, and as we go through these next couple weeks, we're going to, as we talked about last week, answering the question, what child is this? And we sang that hymn this morning. I was really excited that we actually sang the hymn that lined up with the message, with the title exactly. But it's incredible as we just keep learning more and more about this child, how much was laying in that manger that night. And I just keep getting more and more just blown away as we spend time uncovering more of the identity of Christ and who he was, even the night he was born. Last week, Pastor Doug talked to us about how he was a world-saving baby. And this week, we're gonna add to that list of things that's just so incredible about this child. And we're going to talk about him being a king. So before we really dive in, let's watch the Skit Guys video for this week.
What child is this? Yes. Yes, that is the question. That has always been the question. What child is this? That single question was the driving force behind our lengthy journey. We had to figure out what child this is. And I know. My friends, we have been called wise by many of the people we encountered along our journey, if even for a brief moment, I hesitate to give much credence to their judgment. But it is known, or it should be known, that knowledge is acquired by keeping one's eyes open and mouth shut. So, may I suggest that you keep your mouths closed and your ears open, and I will, to the best of my ability, answer your question as clear as I can. One, we did not stumble upon this child. No, we found a needle in a haystack. And how did we find this needle? We followed the star. I know. To many, that would be considered a fool's errand, but we are no fools. No, that star was moved by some unseen force. And who moves stars but God? Two, we encountered that corrupt king. That king wanted us to find the child so that he could worship the child. My friends, do kings worship babies? No. Kings defend their thrones. And that king, that Herod, is a ruthless and cruel despot. It does not take a wise man to discern that. And that king felt that this child was a threat. And mark my words, that child is a threat to all who are cruel and ruthless. And three, I don't have words for three.
My entire life I have searched. And yet it was always just beyond the horizon of my knowing. Until, in an instant, I crossed a threshold, and there it was. That father, that mother, that star, the child. It was all there. All my searching, all my studying. It was all right there. All in that child. How could I not worship him? I need search no more.
Kind of hard to follow. Kind of really hits on a lot of really powerful things about that child. But I think the story of the Magi, of the wise men, is a really incredible story. These guys that we don't know a whole ton about can teach us a lot of significant things about what child this is. And Matthew is the only gospel that includes the story of the Magi. So I want to take a little bit of time this morning, and I want us to just kind of walk through the story. We're going to read it, but we're going to kind of pause and talk as we go. Just try to focus on some different things as we read through the story. So we're in Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 through 12. I'm going to just kind of read and kind of we can meditate on some stuff as we go. Starting in verse 1. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem. There are a lot of reasons to believe that the Magi didn't show up at the manger. We always, when we put up our nativity scenes, we always include them because they're a big part of the Christmas story. But they weren't necessarily at the manger. Most believe that they didn't arrive to see and meet Jesus until he was like 2 years old. So one, that shows they traveled quite a distance to find him. Took them a long time to get there. So after Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, moving on to verse 2, asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." They have come knowing that this baby is a king. They already knew that. They didn't come and meet him and find out. They knew in advance that he was a king, the Messiah. How? How did they know that? I think that's a really good question. How on earth did they know in advance that this baby that they've never met was the king, was the Messiah? Well, the people of the East, who a lot of people believe were maybe like in the Babylonian area, like of Babylon, but they had a lot of opportunities to hear about the Jewish scriptures. If you remember, for a while there, the Israelites were in captivity in Babylon. And so, I mean, Daniel got pretty high up, and he made it pretty clear that he never backed down on sharing these things. So that's one way that things would have spread through Babylon. But also, after people returned, there's a decent chance that not everybody left. Maybe some people had settled in a little bit, and they've still been there. And so for these like 600 years since Daniel was there, you know, since captivity ended, they're still hearing about some of these stories from the people who still live there. And they maintained just this large presence in that area for a while. That explains how they could have heard about the prophecies. But it doesn't necessarily tell us how they knew that this star in the sky meant that that king that they're talking about is born. It just seems so hard to figure out. Maybe in their familiarity with the scriptures, they ran across Numbers 24:17, which says, "I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star will come out of Jacob. A scepter will rise out of Israel." A star will rise. A star will come out of Jacob. A scepter will rise. That could be one of the ways they found out. Another, that it doesn't necessarily hint at this in Scripture or not, but if you look at the rest of the story, the rest of how God has paved the way and how God has set this story up, it's possible that he told them. He came to Mary as an angel and told her what was going to happen. He showed up to Joseph in a dream and told him what was going to happen. He later shows up to the wise men in a dream and tells them not to go back the same way. So it's not that far-fetched to think maybe he told them, "Go find my son." But we don't know enough about the wise men and the beginning of their story to know exactly what has happened here. While these are plausible possibilities, we just don't know for sure exactly how they knew that this baby was a king, but they did. They showed up asking, "Where is the baby that's being born that's the king of the Jews?" They were looking for him. And this is probably why they went to Jerusalem first. Jerusalem's a pretty good guess at where a Jewish king would be born. So they're following the star, but can you imagine how hard it would be to follow a star? Like if you just looked up and picked a star and just started like traveling? Like how hard? I mean, I know this one is probably significantly brighter than the rest of the stars, but it's so far off, like it would be really hard to follow a star. So they were following the star as their guide to make sure they ended up in the right place. But it's pretty good assumption to go to Jerusalem first if it's supposed to be a Jewish king and he might be born in Jerusalem. Verse 3, when King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Messiah was to be born. So he wasn't aware. Like he didn't know the scriptures, even though he lived among the Jewish people. And they said, "In Bethlehem, in Judea," they replied, "for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel." For just point of reference, that quote, that prophecy that they're talking about is from Micah chapter 5, verse 2. This is further confirmation that this kid is a king. And it helps them get a more exact location. On the one hand, it helps the wise men know more specifically where to look. On the bad end, it helps Herod know exactly where to look. And we know that's not a good part of the story, and that's coming. Because verse 7, then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. Why would he need to know the exact time the star appeared? But it's a pretty good guess based on his actions later that he was looking for a window to figure out about the age of the kid. So he asked them, well, that star that you guys started following, when did that show up? And they tell him about 2 years ago, and he goes, okay, 2 years ago. And then later in verse 16, we see he orders his men to go and find any boy 2 years and under and take him out. Because as they said in the video, he didn't want to worship this kid. He wanted to remove the threat to his throne. He was a ruthless king, and he was concerned about some king coming in and taking his power. It brings to mind like this concept of Saul and David, where Saul is still the acting king, but he knows that David has been anointed as the next king. And I mean, we've got chapters upon chapters of David being tracked down by Saul. He's trying to take him out. He was trying to protect his throne, even in that case where his throne was given to him by God. So it's not that strange for a king to want to protect his throne. He sees a threat. And in the video he said, that baby is a threat to the kind of kingdom that Herod was running. So, verse 8. This is what he does in response. He sent them to Bethlehem, the Magi, and said, go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him. After they had heard the king, they went on their way. And the star they had seen when it rose went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. So they get put on the right track. They're headed to Bethlehem. They get out there. The star's on the move again. Did you notice that part? It went ahead of them until it stopped. It was moving. That's weird. The star in the sky is moving. Does that happen? It appears like they're moving because we are rotating, but only one star is moving differently than the rest of them. The star that they've been following. That's pretty crazy. It was guiding them. This star is what started their journey to begin with. If they knew that prophecy from Numbers 24 about the star and the king, and being from the east, there's a decent chance that they studied the stars. And a lot of people believe that they were into that stuff. They spent a lot of time studying the sky. And if you spend a lot of time studying something and suddenly something looks different, you notice it. You notice that something has changed and that catches your attention and you're like, okay, what's going on here? That wasn't there before. And so they start spending more time thinking about this star and trying to figure out what this star means. And I found something that a New Testament scholar said. He said, when something important was happening on earth, you should expect to see it reflected in the heavens. Alternatively, a remarkable event among the stars and planets must mean they thought that there was a remarkable event on earth. So they see the star and they go, well, that's kind of a remarkable event in the sky. So that must mean there's a remarkable event on earth. We got to go find it. They start piecing all this together. And they take off on a couple thousand mile journey. When they saw the star rising in the sky, they said, something's up. The king of the Jews has been born. And we got to go find him. We got to go worship him. Not we got to go get something from him, but we got to go worship him. We got to go give him gifts. I don't know how, I mean, because I've never seen a star moving through the sky guiding me anywhere. I don't know if any of you have, but I haven't. So I don't know how that works. I don't know how you track a star in the sky, I don't know how the star moved. I don't know what that looked like. But Matthew makes it pretty clear here in this passage that God was guiding these men to his son. He was trying to get them there to meet his son and to worship him. Verse 10, it's a simple verse. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. They were nearing the end of a 2-year journey. Like, they were within miles of what they've been searching for thousands of miles. I mean, have you guys ever been just this close to finishing a project or on a journey, and like, you get to the home stretch and you're just, there's just this excitement that starts to build. You're like, I'm almost there. I'm almost done. I know, I'm sure you felt the same way, but when I was getting ready to turn in my last paper for my master's program, like, the excitement was like building, like, this is it. I'm almost at the end. This is going to be awesome. So like, I can imagine this journey that they've been on for thousands of miles, not really 100% knowing where they were going or what they were looking for, is almost done. They're super excited. Verse 11, on coming to the house, which is also another thing that helps us realize that they didn't show up at the manger. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Now, I remember growing up reading this, and I'm like, those are weird gifts. Like, why did they bring gold, frankincense, and myrrh? Part of that was because when I was a kid, I was like, what is frankincense and myrrh? Like, I don't know what those things are. But the wise men gave expensive gifts because they were the type of gifts that were worthy for a future king. Now, gold was a gift for a king. When you're coming to a king, that's a good gift. You bring him gold. That's a gift for a king. Frankincense, which, if you don't know what it is like a glittering kind of odorous gum that you get from certain trees. And that was considered a gift for deity. And myrrh, that was a valued spice and perfume that they could also get from trees. And that was used in the process of embalming, which you would think would be a gift for a person that you know is going to die. So we've got a gift for a king, a gift for deity, and a gift for someone you know is going to die. That's incredible to think about. Even the way this was orchestrated and the gifts that they brought to him, it's telling us exactly who he is. King, God, and that he was going to die. Now, this is one thing that I hadn't really thought of before, but as I was kind of working through this story this week, this popped out at me, and I was like, why would God have these men go thousands of miles and show up for his son, to meet his son and bring him these gifts? I mean, it's God. It's the Son of God being born, and that's pretty cool that you get to be there for that. But why would God send these guys? And these gifts, you think of the value of these gifts and how much they would be worth. These gifts probably provided the financial resources that this young family needed to flee to Egypt and come back a couple years later. Resources that they would not have otherwise had God not sent these men with these gifts to continue to pave the way for what Christ was really meant to do, for the reign that he is meant to have. Because if they didn't go, they wouldn't have been able to... That family wouldn't have been able to flee Herod. They wouldn't have had the money. God provided for them in this way, in this miraculous story. Verse 12, and having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. They were sure of what Herod was really about and what his real intention was. And they're told, hey, go home a different way. That way, because if you go through Jerusalem, there's no way you're gonna make it. I mean, if they're these guys wearing outfits like this, riding on camels, dressed like that, they're going to stick out like a sore thumb going back through Jerusalem, and Herod's going to track them down, and there's no way they're going to get away without telling him where that baby is. And so God, again, paves the way for Christ. And he tells them to go home a different way. And now that they've been there, and they've searched, and they've met the Son of God, they're like, yeah, okay, I'll go home the long way. There's already thousands of miles, and now they're going the long way home, as if the couple thousand miles was the short way. They're going home a different way to help protect this child, to help protect this king, because they know that his reign is going to be important. The story is incredible to me. To see what God did to orchestrate and to pave the road for Christ to be king. There's another thing in Matthew that's kind of interesting. He opens his book with a genealogy. I mean, if you're trying, you know, if you're going for, you know, getting people to read it, I don't know, that's not what he's going for, but if you're writing a book, you're not going to start with like some kind of genealogy, like these, just a whole list of facts and expect people to keep reading, right? I can't imagine that would be a good way to write a book. But he starts off with a genealogy. The first, like, 17 verses. He doesn't start with the story of the wise men and Bethlehem or even Mary and Joseph. He starts with Abraham begot Isaac. Isaac begot Jacob. Jacob begot Judah and his brothers. Judah begot Perez and Zerah by Tamar. Perez begot Hezron and Hezron begot Ram. That's not even the whole thing. The list keeps going on and on for another 16 verses. Gets to Obed begot Jesse, and Jesse begot David the king. David the king begot Solomon. Why does Matthew start talking about Abraham and David and Solomon before he gets to Mary and Joseph? Because this genealogy shows us he's a descendant of Abraham, the father of many nations. He's a descendant of David, the king. You know, the genealogy gives us legal and royal lineage through Joseph, which shows Jesus as king. Which is actually the whole reason they went to Bethlehem for the census to begin with, because they were in the line of David. And they had to go there to the town of David for the census. They had to go to their hometown. And so we're reminded several times here that he is in the line of David. 2 Samuel 7:16, David gets a promise. And your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. That's quite a promise. But he knew when he made that promise that Jesus was going to come from that line. And that Jesus will reign as king forever. No matter what happens, Jesus is on his throne, fulfilling that promise that God made to David. And that's why it's important that there's a genealogy at the beginning of Matthew. Because it shows us that Jesus is in line to be king and that he's a fulfillment of a promise that that throne will last forever. I always wondered why Matthew would include a genealogy at the start of his book, but he's making a concerted effort to show us that this child that's about to be born is king. Why is it important for us to know that this child was a king? think that's a question we need to answer this morning. And I'll kind of start answering that question with another question. What does a king do for his people? A good king at least looks out for what's best for his people. He leads them into times of peace and to take care of them and to do what's best for them so that the kingdom can be successful. Today we lit the candle of peace. And as the Colvins read, Christ comes to bring justice, wholeness, and harmony to every relationship throughout all creation. He wants to continually grant us peace in every situation. A king should desire that his people can live at peace. And I think this story calls for a little bit of a comparison between types of kings. We've got Herod in this story, who is a ruthless king, who wanted to do everything he could to protect his power. And he kept his power with a tool of fear. He told his men to go and kill every baby 2 years and under to protect his throne. Can you imagine if, like, somebody who is running a country, like nowadays, declared, hey, go and kill every kid that's 2 years and under? There would be like an uproar in the world. Not that there's not bad things happening. But this is what he did just to keep his power. It was about him being in charge, not about what was best for his people. And the Israelites had been told of the coming of the Messiah for a really, really long time. And they always just looked forward to it as this king that was going to come and he was going to overthrow Rome and they wouldn't have to be under Herod's thumb anymore. They didn't have to live in fear of Herod anymore. They wanted this powerful, earthly king. But Jesus came as a different kind of king. He didn't come as the king they were expecting. But he came as the king they needed. He refuses to come in power. But instead, he shows up in vulnerability. He came as a baby who was born in a barn. He refuses to come in power. He does not vow retribution, even on the people who would crucify him. They put him on a cross. And it was never about getting them back and taking care of those people who were going to threaten his rule. He would not come down off his cross to show he was king, because that wasn't the kind of king that he was. He remained up there as a representative of all who suffer. And he does not promise a better tomorrow. He offers to redeem us today. Think about that criminal that was on the cross next to him. He didn't tell him, someday I'll see you in heaven. He said, today you will be with me in paradise. Today you will be with me in paradise. In these words, Jesus focused on this moment, promising that those who believe in him, promising that those who seek him, promising that those who worship him would come into God's presence immediately. Jesus stands with the innocent of the world, with the vulnerable and the forgotten, all those who suffer injustice and oppression, things that Herod, as a king, would never have done. But we have to ask ourselves, what kind of king do you want? The answer that most gave, both in the first century and even now in the 21st century, is not that one. Preferring instead some kind of demonstration of power over vulnerability. If we choose to live in a world where things are made right through power and strength, that's eventually going to lead to ruin. If we look more to a king who lives under the eye for an eye idea, we're going the wrong direction. At those moments, Jesus reminds us that far from promising us a better future is forgiveness and grace and mercy and peace today. And he gives us a chance to stand with the innocent and the vulnerable and the broken and the people who need him. Matthew 6:24 says, "No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money." When we attempt to answer this question of which kind of king do you want, we're led to this verse. Because we're all faced with the inescapable choice about whom we will serve. Which kind of king do you want? Who are you going to serve? And either we store up our treasures in heaven with God, we focus our eyes on Jesus, and we serve him alone, or we don't serve him at all. He calls us to serve him. He calls us to seek him as the wise men did when they went on a 2-year, couple thousand mile journey. They gave up everything. They left their livelihood in the east to go searching for this king. And Jeremiah 29:13 says, "You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart." They gave up everything. They sought with all of their heart, and they found him. How have you been searching for him? Have you been searching for him? Or if you ask yourself the question, what kind of king do you want? Is he even your answer? Is he the kind of king you even want? When you honestly answer that question, is he the one you would choose? He may not be the kind of king that you want, but he's the kind of king that you need. This child king offers us mercy and grace and peace, a peace that surpasses all understanding. So much peace that we don't even get it. We feel peace when it just doesn't make sense. No king who rules by fear can get us that peace. Because we will never live at peace as long as we live in fear. So seek after him with all your heart. And there's a promise. If you seek after him with all your heart, you will find him. And when you find him, what is your response? Because when they found him, they walked through the door and they bowed down and worshiped him. They didn't start asking him for stuff. They didn't start asking him to fulfill this need and that need and to do this and to do that. But they bowed down and they worshiped him. So when you seek him with all your heart and you find him as you are promised you will, worship him. Because he's on his throne forever. Let's pray. Lord God, just challenge us on that question. Who's it about? Which kind of king do we want? Lord, I pray that you would do a work in our hearts that would draw us to yourself. Even if it takes something as miraculous as putting a star in the sky for us to follow to get to you, help us to find you. Lord, help us to start searching so that we can find you. And Lord, as we come before you this morning, we give you worship. In your name we pray. Amen.